If you have a copy of the outline, then I will be following it fairly closely. In the year 312, the Roman Empire acquired its first Christian ruler, Constantine, who for the next 12 years ruled only the western half of the empire. In 313, Constantine and the then Eastern Emperor Licinius agreed in Milan on a policy of favour towards the Christian Church, while allowing all others to follow their own religious convictions. The so-called Edict of Milan, which one historian has described as one of the major documents in the history of human freedom, cannot be discussed in isolation from a long history of often troubled relationships between church and empire, or without reference to the aftermath of Constantine's conversion. And I propose to say something briefly about the history of persecution. First of all, the need for a perspective where this subject is concerned. It is important not to exaggerate the sufferings of the early Christians. The standard impression which people have of the early persecutions is derived, directly or indirectly, from a brief passage in Tacitus, a Roman historian of the early 2nd century. In his account of Nero's reign, Tacitus, writing some 50 years afterwards, describes what happened to the Christians in Rome after the great fire of AD 64. To quote just a few lines, "To get rid of the report that Nero himself had started the fire, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the people. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames." This account has been mediated to many people through modern books and films, notably Quo Vadis. But what is often not appreciated is that this passage in Tacitus describes an isolated and untypical outburst of violence. And relatively few Christians living under the Roman authorities were subjected to violence of this kind. But violence there was, and some reasons for Roman hostility towards Christians. As the church grew, so too did the tension between the Christian message and Roman culture. It is a distressing fact of human history that distinctive minorities attract suspicion, contempt, and violence, and Christianity had certain features which made it an obvious target for Roman hatred, particularly when people had learned to differentiate between Christianity and Judaism. A new and wicked superstition, a phrase found in the Roman writer Suetonius. Christianity was not the religion of a particular race or nation. It could not be regarded as part of the culture or the ancestral heritage of any particular ethnic group. Christianity was new. It had a very short and very dubious pedigree, and it showed no respect for barriers of race, religion, class, or tradition. In the words of a modern historian, Christianity was novel, and the Roman world was, in many ways, politically, economically, and intellectually very conservative. The Christians were those who had forsaken the customs of their forefathers in order to embrace what Suetonius called a new and wicked superstition. Christians were atheists. The Romans could be very sensitive where religion was concerned. They expected the empire's subject to respect the gods of Rome, even if only as symbols of Rome's power and greatness. For the devotees of most religions, it was not a problem to respect the gods of Rome in addition to their own deities. Christians, however, would have nothing to do with Roman religion, even by way of a token gesture. Christians were sometimes blamed for bringing down the anger of the gods upon society generally. The early Christian writer Tertullian sardonically summed up the attitude of many of his pagan contemporaries. If the Tiber reaches the walls, if the Nile does not rise to the fields, if the sky doesn't move or the earth does, if there is famine, if there is plague, the cry is at once the Christians to the lion, Christianos ad leonem. And then Christian crimes. The 2nd century Christian writer Minucius Felix records some comments of a Roman orator, and quoting some of this report, this Roman orator says, "They, the Christians, have gathered together from the lowest dregs of the populace ignorant men and credulous women, and women are naturally unstable, and have formed a rabble of impious conspirators. At their nocturnal gatherings, solemn fasts, and barbarous meals, the bond of union is not any sacred rite, but crime. They are a secret tribe that lurks in darkness and shuns the light." End of quotation. It seems that Christians were accused of cannibalism and gross indecency, perhaps garbled versions of the Eucharist and the Christian emphasis on love and sharing. A number of early Christian writers testify to such misinformation, and they challenge their pagan contemporaries to produce any evidence that such charges are based on fact. At one point, Tertullian again comments, "No name of a crime stands against us, but only the crime of a name." To be a Christian was enough to provoke contempt and hatred. There is no name of a crime. There is no nomen criminis. There is only the crime of a name, a crimen nominis. So, certainly, persecutions there were, hostility there was. But we move on to the triumph of the church, a phrase found in a number of history books. How was it that Christianity became the dominant religion of the empire? How did we get to the situation that we see in 313, how did this small sect become so influential that eventually the empire itself became Christian? History shows that some societies and cultures offer particularly strong resistance to the gospel, whereas others are more sympathetic and responsive. The growth of the church in some societies, as opposed to others, cannot be understood apart from certain cultural and historical factors. So what was it about Roman religion and culture which contributed to so many abandoning the religion of their ancestors and joining the church? And first among the factors that I've identified is the shapelessness of Roman religion. The more sharply focused and carefully defined a religion is, the more likely it is to offer effective opposition to an opponent or a competitor. Roman religion was a religion without a creed. It lacked a set of specific beliefs which might really grip the heart and satisfy the intellect. It was a religion marked by, in the words of another modern historian, indeterminate gods and colourless myths, mere fables concocted from details suggested by Latin topography or pale reflections of the adventures which had overtaken the Olympians of Greek epic. End of quotation. The number of available gods with their various specialities was open-ended. Successive rulers had their favourite deities, as can be seen from coins, which declare one or another god to be the emperor's companion. The Roman world seemed to be positively ripe for a sharply focused and uncompromising creed, a creed for which men and women would be prepared to die if necessary. Then the universality of the Christian faith. Well before the birth of Christianity, many subjects of the empire were being attracted to Judaism, precisely because it had qualities which Roman religion lacked, and which some Romans admired. An uncompromising belief in one God, as distinct from a ridiculous multitude of deities, a form of worship that had none of the barbaric rituals of so much pagan religion, and a very high ethical and moral tone. Christianity had one great advantage over Judaism in the matter of attracting those who were dissatisfied with Roman religion. Christianity was not the religion of a particular people or race. Christianity crossed ethnic and cultural boundaries in a way that Judaism did not. Converts to Judaism were always felt by the Jews to be in some sense aliens, even when, in the case of men, they were prepared to take the step of circumcision. And many Gentile men preferred to remain adherents, observers, rather than become full converts. The Christian church, however, was able to incorporate people from any culture or way of life. The evangelizing zeal of Christians. Acts 8, we are told that those who were scattered from Jerusalem in the persecution which followed Stephen's death preached the word wherever they went. The preaching and spreading of the gospel was not the work of professionals, full-time workers, or even apostles exclusively. Ordinary Christians felt a responsibility to evangelize their neighbors. Judaism was to a certain extent a proselytizing religion, but its identification with one particular race and the Jewish tendency to remain separate from Gentiles meant that Judaism lacked the mobility of Christianity. Furthermore, among many Jews, the universal vision had faded. As for traditional Roman religion, no concept would have been more foreign to the devotees than the idea of winning converts. But from the beginning, the Christian church was marked by an evangelizing zeal, to which an awareness of Christ's imminent return and of the wrath of God gave a special urgency. The Christian hope. Pagan religion and philosophy had little to offer by way of an afterlife. Mystery religions might offer some kind of eventual release of the soul from the body's prison, but this was usually available only to the select few, and even then only by means of some rather repelling rites. Judaism was vague on the subject of life after death. Christianity, on the other hand, offered what many people wanted: the certainty of complete acceptance by God, the assurance of everlasting bliss, the promise that the sufferings of the present world would be more than compensated for by the glories of the next, the confidence that in Christ good had triumphed over evil. From the very beginning, Christianity was eschatological. It was marked by a firm belief in the complete victory of God and of Christ, which would be manifested when the last things came to pass. The earliest Christians awaited the imminent coming of Christ. And even though this sense of the imminence of Christ's return became less marked as the centuries passed, the Christian church held firmly to the belief in the resurrection of the body and the life of the world to come, to quote the Nicene Creed. When Peter, 1 Peter 1:3, spoke of a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, he was speaking of the type of experience for which many people in the ancient world longed. Christian morality, charity, and courage. Accusations of cannibalism, incest, and orgies actually may never have been very widespread, and they probably faded with the passing of time. Pagans became aware that Christians had strict principles and showed great care for each other, and indeed, Christian charity extended to those outside the church. Henry Chadwick, a distinguished historian of an earlier generation, says the practical application of charity was probably the most single cause of Christian success. He may be overstating the point, but there is a point there. The early Christians should not be idealized. They were not perfect or sinless, but there is no doubt that Christian virtues had an impact on a world where it was not normal to care on a large scale for the poor, the sick, widows, and orphans. Christian morality, like Jewish, had an attraction for those who were disgusted with pagan immorality. In addition, there is evidence that Christian courage in the face of martyrdom made a profound impression on some non-Christians. The intellectual appeal of Christianity. There soon developed an impressive Christian intellectual tradition. During the second and third centuries, a solid body of apologetic literature was produced. Much of it was designed to argue that Christians were not guilty of the crimes which popular slander attributed to them, that Christian morality was superior to pagan, and that Christianity was a religion worthy of intelligent people. Wisdom could be known in its fullness in Christianity, but at best only partially in the great pagan sages. Around 170 AD, the pagan intellectual Celsus published a major work attacking Christianity. What is significant about Celsus' work is that he felt the need to deal with Christian claims and to disprove them. The fierceness of Celsus' attack indicates that Christianity was making an impression on thinking people, and Celsus writes in order to dissuade intellectual scholars from becoming Christians. There would have been no point in writing such a sustained attack for the mob, as they could not or would not have read it. About a century later, another pagan scholar, Porphyry, saw that Christianity did not only appeal to the lowest classes, but was also becoming increasingly influential among the educated, and this disturbed Porphyry. The lack of a consistent Roman policy. During the era of persecutions, as it's known from the beginning up to Constantine, the church was able to grow, to debate, and to become a major factor in society, partly because the Romans were sporadic, half-hearted, and inconsistent in their dealings with the church. The imperial authorities had to deal with many other problems, political, military, economic, And more importantly, they lacked the religious or ideological fanaticism which a successful policy of extermination needs. By and large, the people had no great interest in seeing a final solution, Nazi style, to the Christian issue, and neither had their rulers. The idea that Christians were a threat to the empire wore rather thin, not only because of the lives which Christians lived, but because the empire's worst troublemakers, problems and enemies, internal and external, obviously had nothing to do with Christianity. Christianity thus became firmly established in Roman society, although it remained the religion of a minority. Its influence at the beginning of the 4th century was such that the empire became nominally Christian. And so we move to the Great Persecution, as it's become known in history, and its aftermath. In the year 303, Diocletian, emperor from 284, began an intensive persecution of the church, which proved to be the empire's last major offensive against the church. The Great Persecution lasted longer and was more severe in the empire's eastern provinces than in the west. Shortly after he became emperor in 284, Diocletian had divided his empire in order to make its general administration easier. He himself retained overall command, but with special responsibility for the eastern provinces. In the east, Diocletian and his successor Galerius pursued a vigorous policy of persecution. The rulers in the western half of the empire had little taste or time for persecuting Christians. They had too many other things to do, particularly fighting amongst themselves. The Great Persecution continued steadily in the eastern provinces during the period 303 to 312. However, towards the end of that period, Galerius, the eastern ruler since 305, when Diocletian abdicated, decided that the empire was wasting valuable time and resources on its campaign against the church. And he issued an edict of toleration in April 311. This formally accorded to Christians the right to exist unmolested, but it did not end persecution completely, and it was not the decisive factor in the transformation of the Christian faith into the established religion of the empire. The edict was not unambiguously Christian, and there was nothing in it that attacked paganism. What is significant about Galerius' edict is that a Roman ruler was prepared to recognize officially the power and influence of the church within the empire. But even apart from this toleration edict of 311, events elsewhere were moving very much in favor of Christianity. Constantine's rise to power. While Diocletian and then Galerius were ruling the east, the western half of the empire saw a succession of rulers, of whom the most significant is undoubtedly Constantine. Constantine himself eventually joined in the imperial infighting in the western provinces, and after a period as vice ruler of the west, in 312 he defeated the reigning emperor Maxentius at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in October 312, thus gaining control of the Western Empire. A man of Constantine's upbringing and position would inevitably have come into contact with Christianity at some stage. The precise nature of Constantine's acquaintance with Christianity in the years before he achieved supreme power is difficult to determine. Whatever the background, Constantine emerged victorious at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, having publicly acknowledged his allegiance to the God of the Christians. According to later Christian accounts, Constantine received divine aid in this decisive engagement. Constantine's contemporary, the historian Lactantius, writes, "Constantine was directed in a dream to mark the heavenly sign of God on the shields of his soldiers and thus to join battle." Another contemporary, Eusebius of Caesarea, relates what is supposed to be Constantine's own testimony. He said that about noon, when the day was already beginning to decline, he saw with his own eyes the trophy of a cross of light in the heavens above the sun and an inscription, "Conquer by this sign," in hoc signo vinces. It is not easy to separate fact from legend in a case like this. Possibly Constantine did have some kind of profound religious experience, perhaps involving a dream shortly before the battle. We can call this experience a conversion, in that he was obviously converted from one form of religious allegiance to the other. But whether Constantine really understood the essentials of the Christian faith is difficult to say. It could be that his new allegiance was to the God of the Christians, only vaguely understood, rather than to Christ. And another historian of modern times suggests that Constantine, quote, "saw the cross not so much as an emblem of suffering as a magic totem confirming his own victoriousness." However it came about, and whatever its precise nature, Constantine's conversion opens a new chapter in church history. In 313, Constantine, as ruler of the West, and Licinius, the new ruler of the East, agreed at a meeting in Milan to grant both to the Christians and to all others full authority to follow whatever worship each man has desired. And to quote some other brief extracts from an English version of the edict preserved for us by the historian Lactantius, "The emperors declare, 'We thought it salutary and most proper to establish our purpose that no man whatever should be refused complete toleration who has given up his mind either to the cult of the Christians or to the religion which he personally feels best suited to himself.'" Their purpose is not only to grant freedom to Christians, but they say to others also, freedom for their own worship and cult is likewise left open and freely granted, that every man may have complete toleration in the practice of whatever worship he has chosen. Not only should all persecution cease, but also, according to the edict, all property taken from the Christian church should be restored, something which Galerius' edict of 311 did not require. Constantine and Licinius obviously saw the Christian religion as the chief religion of the empire, with traditional Roman religion coming under the heading of any other cult. For the Christians of the eastern provinces, the era of persecutions was still not completely finished. Licinius, ruler of the east, accepted the fact that Christians were here to stay, but he was determined to make life as difficult for them as he could. However, after years of tension between the two emperors, in September 324, Constantine defeated Licinius in battle and so achieved mastery over the whole empire. A little more than 20 years after Diocletian had launched the great persecution, the empire, east and west, was under the rule of a Christian emperor. So a new role for the Roman emperor. Constantine was hailed by Christians as God's deputy on earth, the representative of the divine word. Eusebius of Caesarea says that, quote, our emperor, his, that is the divine word's friend, acting as interpreter to the word of God, aims at recalling the whole human race to the knowledge of God. At the time of Constantine's victory in 312 at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, Maxentius, the defeated emperor, perished in the river Tiber, along with many of his soldiers. This, of course, led to Constantine being seen as a new Moses. Few people thought it strange that the emperor should take a personal interest in the affairs of the church. For his part, Constantine felt it his duty to secure peace in the empire by healing rifts in the church. A major dispute to which Constantine gave his attention was the Arian controversy. Arius had been causing a considerable stir with his view that Christ was a created being. When Constantine became ruler of the Eastern Empire in 324, he decided to act, and he summoned the Great Council of Nicaea, 325, which eventually issued a creed condemning Arian-type beliefs. And also a new relationship between church and empire. Christianity did not require the dismantling of the imperial structures or of much of Roman culture. The emperor was seen as God's representative. The administration of the provinces and the taxation system remained in place. The notion of the just war legitimized the killing of one's enemies. Rich people could be accepted into the church without giving away all their wealth. Art and architecture could be channeled into expressing Christian values. Instead of seeing them as essentially in conflict, it was now possible to see the Christian church and Romanitas as two parts of one great divine plan. The corollary of a Christian ruler is the idea of a Christian empire or state. The church was granted special privileges and became the special object of imperial favour. Bishops travelling to and from church synods were allowed to travel at imperial expense. Churches received endowments, and the church as a whole took on the aspect of a vast and secure corporation. The Roman army began to acquire Christian insignia. The result of all this imperial favour towards the church was that it became highly advantageous to be a Christian. Serious measures to eradicate paganism did not begin until well into the reign of Theodosius I, who became emperor in 379. Nevertheless, the new and privileged status of the church meant that many people accepted Christianity simply because it was convenient to do so. Pagans were not at first faced with physical persecution of the type once inflicted upon Christians, though that would come, but they could easily conclude that it was more profitable to be a Christian than not to be one. And so the church becomes a persecutor. The promise of religious freedom, which the Edict of Milan seemed to embody, did not become a reality. In time, the new church-empire relationship led to active persecution of dissidents, deviants. In the early 5th century, Augustine justified the use of force against the dissident Donatist movement in North Africa, quoting the words from the gospel story, "Compel them to come in." The principle that the security of the empire required ecclesiastical uniformity is seen to a certain extent in Constantine's day. That's why he was so anxious to end the Arian and the Donatist controversies. On his authority, bishops could lose their positions, sometimes being forcibly removed by soldiers who then installed an Orthodox bishop. Gradually, it became normal for the Christian empire, the church in effect, making use of the sword of the state, to use force to suppress heretical groups and their beliefs. Wrong belief was seen as evil in and of itself. It was felt to be a ruler's duty to exterminate such evil. Religious intolerance, including book burning, would become a sad feature of the Christian empire. And finally, we come to the postscript. The concept of the Corpus Christianum, or the Corpus Christianorum, the Christian body, where church and society are virtually identified, was a feature of medieval culture which the main reformers did not reject. As we know, they rejected so much else. The papacy, 5 of the sacraments to which Rome held, the concept of purgatory. They rejected so much, but they did not reject this feature of medieval Europe, the idea of a Christian society, a Christian body. They were not advocates of freedom of conscience. The Anabaptists, whom we can regard as our spiritual forebears, we who are Baptists, however, were different, and they introduced what was in the 16th century seen as a highly dangerous, a highly subversive philosophy, that church and empire should be separate, and really the civil government has no right to be involved in the affairs of the church. One of the earliest representatives of the English Baptist movement, Thomas Helwys, wrote a book published in 1612, A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity, in which Helwys made his famous plea for religious toleration, which in some ways, he may himself not have been interested in this, echoes something of the spirit of the Edict of Milan. In his book, addressing directly King James, Helwys says, "O let the king judge. Is it not most equal, most fair, in modern English, that men should choose their religion themselves, seeing they only must stand themselves before the judgment seat of God to answer for themselves? And if the king's people be obedient and true subjects, obeying all human laws made by the king shall not answer for it. For men's religion to God is between God and themselves. Neither may the king be judged between God and man. Let them be heretics, Turks, Jews, or whatsoever. It appertains not to the earthly power to punish them in the least measure. And particularly daring, given the anti-Catholic feeling in early 17th century England, Helwys believed that such liberty should be extended to, quote, them of the Romish religion, if they are true and faithful subjects of the king. For we do freely profess that our Lord the King has no more over their conscience, has no more power over their consciences than over ours, and that is none at all. So the Edict of Milan, which again a historian has described as one of the major documents in the history of human freedom, sadly did not materialize into real freedom of conscience and freedom of religion in Constantine's empire and the remaining history of the Western Empire, the subsequent thousand-year history of the Eastern Empire, the state of church-state relations in medieval Europe. Sadly, the promise did not materialize, but at least there were those who eventually took up the same sentiments and established them as the proper way to understand the relationship between the king and people's consciences. Thank you.